Right. My name is Elissa Midas. I'm a medical epidemiologist with the Division of Viral Diseases at CDC. And I have no conflicts of interest to disclose. Background. Persistent infection with human papillomavirus, or HPV, can cause cervical cancers as well as some vulvar, vaginal, penile, oropharyngeal, anal, and rectal cancers. An average of 38,793 HPV-associated cancers were diagnosed annually among U.S. men and women during 2008-12. An average of 30,700, or 79% of these cancers, can be attributed to HPV. Cervical cancers are among the most common, with over 11,000 cases annually. Most of these cancers are likely preventable with early screening and treatment, as well as HPV vaccination programs. In the United States, cervical cancer screening with cytology, or pap smear testing, is recommended for women every 3 years, starting at age 21, or every 5 years if done in conjunction with HPV co-testing in women starting at age 30. Also, HPV vaccination is routinely recommended for U.S. girls and boys at age 11 or 12 years. For those not previously vaccinated, HPV vaccine is also recommended for women through age 26 years and men through age 21 years. There's a need to improve these services. Identifying women who need cervical cancer screening can be challenging, and both overscreening and underscreening occur. As for HPV vaccination, coverage lags behind other adolescent vaccines. The estimated coverage among adolescents aged 13 through 17 years in 2015 was, for at least one dose, 62.8% among girls and 49.8% among boys, and three-dose coverage was even lower. STD clinics have been described as safety net clinics and may provide unique opportunities to reach medically underserved or vulnerable individuals with limited access to primary care. However, a 2011 survey of STD clinics participating in CDC's STD Surveillance Network, or SUN, found that only 7 of 24, or 17%, were offering any HPV vaccine at the time. Our objective was to assess current HPV vaccination practices among STD clinics in the United States as of 2015. We conducted a survey of a large convenience sample of geographically diverse STD clinics identified by members of the National Coalition of STD Directors, or NCSD, representing 65 state, territorial, and local jurisdictions in the United States. Each member was asked to nominate the largest sexual health safety net clinic or clinics providing STD services within their jurisdiction. An online multiple choice survey about clinic characteristics, current clinical services offered, and barriers was administered to clinic directors or designees during October 2014 through February 2015. And descriptive statistics were calculated using SPSS. Results. Complete responses were received from 78, or 55%, of 143 nominated clinics. These were located in 46 U.S. states and territories and represented all four census regions. Most, 74%, were affiliated with local health departments, and some were state health departments, family planning clinics, hospitals, and community health centers. Service areas were mostly urban, 71.8%, although some were rural, suburban, or a combination. Regarding cervical cancer screening, among 78 STD clinics, 37 or 47% offered any type of screening for cervical cancer, 26 or 33% offered both cervical pap smear and HPV testing, 23 or 29% were part of the National Breast and Cervical Cancer Early Detection Program, and 15 or 19% provided follow-up procedures such as colposcopy on site. Barriers to offering cervical cancer screening are shown for non-screening clinics in gray and screening clinics in green. Among all 78 STD clinics, the most commonly reported barriers to offering cervical cancer screening were time constraints related to the competing mission of an STD clinic, reported by 33 or 42%, and poor reimbursement or costs to the clinic, reported by 25 or 32%. Among 41 non-screening clinics, the most commonly reported barriers were time constraints, reported by 25, lack of available follow-up to provide results and referrals if needed, reported by 20, and poor reimbursements or costs to the clinic, reported by 18. None reported transportation by ambulance as a barrier. Among 37 screening clinics, 16 reported no barriers. However, barriers commonly reported by other clinics included cost to patient, reported by 9 clinics. Regarding HPV vaccination, among 78 STD clinics, 60 or 77% offered at least one vaccine, and 52 or 67% offered any HPV vaccine. Most offered HPV vaccine to both female and male patients, and 37 or 47% were participating in the Vaccines for Children program. Barriers to offering HPV vaccination are shown for non-vaccinating clinics in gray and vaccinating clinics in green. Among all 78 STD clinics, the most commonly reported barriers to offering HPV vaccination were community or patient reluctance, reported by 28 or 36%, and poor reimbursement, reported by 20 or 26%. Among the 26 non-vaccinating clinics, the most common barriers were poor reimbursement and vaccine not being stocked in the clinic, both reported by 11 clinics. Among 52 vaccinating clinics, the most commonly reported barrier to expanding this practice was patient or community reluctance, reported by 24 clinics. In conclusion, in a geographically diverse group of 78 STD clinics in 2015, less than half, 39.7%, were providing both cervical cancer screening and HPV vaccination. And some, 25.6%, provided neither service. Opportunities to prevent cervical and other cancers in the setting may be missed. Financing and reimbursement issues were commonly cited barriers. Increasing participation in federally funded programs such as Vaccines for Children or the Breast and Cervical Cancer Early Detection Program might reduce such barriers, at least in part. Further research could identify additional strategies for STD clinics to increase provision of cervical cancer screening and HPV vaccination according to national guidelines. I'd like to thank my many collaborators on this project and thank you for your attention this early in the morning.
This paper is open for discussion. Please come to the microphone and identify yourself and have a conversation.
Hi, Gail Burstein from Erie County, New York. That was a great presentation. Thanks. Just thinking about the type of health services that are offered in STD clinics. I was wondering, were you able to look at like the differences in services between clinics located in Medicaid expansion states versus non-Medicaid expansion states?
That's a really good question. We didn't look at it specifically by Medicaid expansion. We did look at some geographic differences by census region, and I didn't find any of them that were important enough to present today. I'm sure we would find something interesting if we looked at Medicaid expansion.
Hi, I enjoyed your presentation very much. Greg Zimmet from Indiana University. So it's very easy to see a reason for cervical cancer screening services in STD clinics. It seems like in some ways a tougher sell for vaccination. Do you have any sense of the cost effectiveness given that many attendees of STD clinics will already have been infected with quite a few probably high-risk types. And I'm curious about what the CDC's recommendation would be, given that males still don't have a routine recommendation up to age 26, even those who don't attend STD clinics unless they're MSM or immunocompromised. So.
All right, that gives me several things to say. I'm glad you asked that. As to the first point about vaccination in STD clinics, we found that almost 77% of these clinics were offering hepatitis B vaccination. So if the infrastructure is there to provide vaccinations at all, it seems like there may be opportunities to explore whether HPV could also be offered in this setting. So there's certainly no mandate that STD clinics would be required to offer vaccination, but it, since it is nationally recommended, and if this is the only place where people are receiving care, there may be some opportunities there. As far as the prior exposures, likely among patients attending STD clinics, we've done various studies on HPV prevalence, even among high-risk populations, and have found that even when patients in the recommended age group report having had many previous sexual partners, that the chance of having exposure to all of the vaccine types is still fairly low. And so it's true, even if somebody's been exposed to one of the HPV vaccine types, we still recommend vaccinating for the full age range because there's a chance that it will still protect you against the additional types. With the advent of 9-valent vaccine, I would expect that there's even more potential protection for people who have been exposed in the past. That said, we do say that the best time to vaccinate is before exposure, but that's not an excuse not to vaccinate afterwards.
Thank you, Alyssa. Okay. Thanks. Oh, sorry.
I have one more question. Sorry.
You have 1 minute.
Thank you so much, Holly from California. I was just wondering, since HPV vaccination is targeted to youth, I was wondering if you looked at clinics that were in states that had different minor consent laws that would allow youth to consent to vaccination specifically, which is sometimes unique, without parental consent, because I'm not sure how many of the youth attending the STD clinics are coming in with their parents.
That's quite right. And consent laws do differ by state. Even for STI services, HPV vaccination isn't always considered an STI service, so that can be different by state. And a number of our clinics in our study did report that consent issues could be a barrier. We didn't try to represent every state, but that was certainly offered as a barrier sometimes. Thank you.
Thank you.